It's the Burt Cohen Show. Does go on despite having lost two truly great Americans in recent times. Going to play interviews with both of them today on a special Burt Cohen Show. On the first half, play an interview I did with Gore Vidal back in 1981. And on the second half, my most recent and final interview with an old friend, George McGovern. On the first part here, interview with Gore Vidal, it was conducted in his hotel suite at the Ritz-Carlton back in 1981 when I was just 30 years old. He was on his Creation book tour. And a little bit of background on this, I was working at WBCN in Boston at the time as an intern. And he talks on this interview about one of the main characters of the book Creation. And it happens to go along with the fact that Gore Vidal's grandfather was the U.S. Senator Thomas Gore of Oklahoma. And when he was a young boy, Gore Vidal would be helping his blind grandfather on the floor of the U.S. Senate. Of course, Gore Vidal was a lifelong Democrat. He ran for political office twice, including 1982 when he ran for U.S. Senate in California. He was known, of course, for his essays and novels. He wrote for The Nation, The New Yorker, New York Review of Books, and Esquire. He was a longtime critic of American foreign policy. In addition, he characterized the U.S. as a decaying empire from the 1980s onwards, and you'll hear that on this interview. He was most widely regarded, his most widely regarded social novel was Myra Breckinridge. His best historical novels, which had a great deal of truth to them, they were novels, but they presented history very clearly. He wrote Julian, Burr, and Lincoln. His third city, his third novel, The City and the Pillar, outraged conservative critics as one of the first major American novels to feature unambiguous homosexuality. Gore Vidal rejected the terms of homosexual and heterosexual as inherently false, claiming that the majority of individuals had the potential to be pansexual. I interviewed him in 1981. And as you'll hear, I believe on this interview, he describes America as not one nation, but as a bunch of warring tribes. His favorite politician was Huey Long. He also supported Dennis Kucinich for president. He was an active member of World Can't Wait, which actively protested against George W. Bush. Well, let's get right into the interview. Now, this is me from 1981 with Gore Vidal.
Myra Breckinridge, Burr, all, of course, the work of author Gore Vidal, perhaps one of the most controversial writers of our time. Gore Vidal was in Boston recently to plug his new book and wax most eloquently about life, liberty, and his possible pursuit of politics. He spoke with BCN's Burt Cohen and began reading something from his new novel about 5th century Greece. It's called Creation.
I am blind, but I am not deaf. Because of the incompleteness of my misfortune, I was obliged yesterday to listen for nearly 6 hours to a self-styled historian whose account of what the Athenians like to call the Persian Wars was nonsense of a sort that, were I less old and more privileged, I would have risen in my seat at the Odeon and scandalized all Athens by answering him. But then, I know the origin of the Greek wars, and he does not. How could he? How could any Greek? I spent most of my life at the court of Persia, and even now, in my 75th year, I still serve the great king as I did his father, my beloved friend Xerxes, and his father before him, a hero known even to the Greeks as Darius the Great. When the painful reading finally ended, our historian has a very thin and monotonous voice made even less charming by a harsh Dorian accent. My 18-year-old nephew, Democritus, wanted to know if I would like to stay behind and speak to the traducer of Persia. You should, he said, because everybody's staring at you. They know you must be very angry. Democritus is studying philosophy here at Athens. This means that he delights in quarrels. Write that down, Democritus. After all, it is at your request that I am dictating this account of how and why the Greek wars began. I shall spare no one, including you. Where was I? Ah, the Odeon.
Perhaps I shouldn't see any parallels between the civilizations of Greece and of America. Did you mean for that parallel to be drawn? And are there similarities and distinctions?
I suppose that the one political similarity between the Greeks of that time and the Americans of today was the war against Syracuse, a war of expansion, which was begun by the Athenians, who were not capable of carrying it out properly. At the same time, they had a great enemy in Sparta. And the analogy there is, of course, the Vietnam War, which we conducted, which was a ridiculous war, which did not involve our interests. Meanwhile, as we were having a long and constant struggle with that satanic, I say that in quotes, empire, the Soviet Union. So we rather wrecked ourselves, let us hope not as badly, as the Athenians wrecked themselves with their ill-fated Syracusan adventure.
Is the U.S. in a period of decay like Greece was?
I should think decay is an aspect of our life. We filled up the continent, and we were people always on the go. We were essentially a bunch of European hustlers who came over here. We killed the Indians. We brought over black slaves, filled up the continent, poisoned the rivers, poisoned the lakes, built cities we didn't then tend to. Even de Tocqueville, back in the 1830s, was describing the hideousness of the American countryside wherever man had got his hands on it. How beautiful it was until man began to hack down the trees and put up settlements. And de Tocqueville said, you know, that no one cares what anything looks like. Nobody tends nature. They just make a mess, and then once they've made it, ruin their land through overplanting. They then move on, tear down another forest, do the same thing. Well, now we've hit the West Coast, and we have no place to turn but inward or go to outer space, so I think we have a crisis.
What is the bank?
The bank is essentially a code word that I use for the ruling class of the United States, which is a consortium of banks, and Chase Manhattan Bank and Exxon, a few great defense industries and so on, and they, in a sense, own the country. They certainly control the politics of the country, and the Congress reflects pretty much their will. And the bank is in charge now, and the bank is as it has always been. The problem with the bank, I don't mind, it's not a conspiracy. It's just a bunch of people who think alike who own the country, and therefore they don't have to conspire. They all do the same thing at the same time. I wouldn't mind this wealthy elite governing the United States if they could govern properly. But they have no plan. They have no idea what to do. All they've been able to do since 1945 is scream, the Russians are coming. This, and there's a Pavlovian response, the American people, the Congress then appropriates more and more money for the Pentagon budget, which is then lost forever to the people, is money that has been burned and produces no new wealth, doesn't make us any safer than we were before, from the dread satanic enemy, monolithic, atheistic, godless communism, which is forever on the march, even now in El Salvador. So they scream, the Russians are coming. At the moment, the defense budget is 25% of the total federal budget. By 83, Mr. Reagan wants it to be one-third of the total budget. And we will, of course, go bankrupt. And the bank will never be in the hands of the receivers, as nobody receives anything from the bank. But I would say the economy will then go crashing, and we might be able to form a new society, a better society, with a tethered bank.
How do you intend to fight the bank, and do you think you have a chance against them in a possible Senate race in California?
I might. It has to do with a lot of elements that would have to come together, would be in agreement with me against the ruling establishment. It has an awful lot of support out there. The bank is not beloved. The government of the United States is not beloved. The system itself, the politicians are rather despised. I find the average person in California, and I think it's pretty much true across the country, perceive that we have no politics and that the politicians must be representing something other than the people. Take gun control. Something like 70% of the people at any given moment would like some sort of control of the sale of handguns. 70% of the Congress does not want that. I think that's the clearest case. Whom is Congress representing? The people who elected them, or the National Rifle Association? Obviously, the latter.
Why has there never been a left wing in the United States?
Well, there have been attempts, but they usually get co-opted. There was the Populist Party, one of whose heads was my grandfather in the 1890s. And he and his buddy, William Jennings Bryan, made some sort of a deal, which I've never been able to understand, with the Democratic Party. And my grandfather got 30 years in the Senate as a Democratic senator, and William Jennings Bryan got the opportunity to run for president a number of times as a Democratic candidate. That was the end of that party, and that was a real party based on real interests. It was against the banking interests of the East. It was against the railroads, who were then as visible and as vicious as the oil companies today. The Socialist Party started going, has always been in the United States, at least since the 1840s. By 1917, 18, they were polling a couple million votes. And they so alarmed the Democratic president, who was another loyal servant of the bank, Woodrow Wilson, that he threw in prison the head of the Socialist Party, Mr. Eugene V. Debs. In a free country, you go to jail immediately if you try to exercise your freedom. Then when Norman Thomas took over the Socialist Party, he was not thrown in jail. He was largely laughed at, as one by one his propositions were absorbed into the Democratic Party by Franklin Roosevelt. So there is no left. We have a country divided between conservatives and reactionaries, and we have no political parties. We have one party with two wings, one called Republican, one called Democratic. And they are all financed by the same people.
How soon do you think that the country will swing away from the right-wing course that it's presently on?
I don't think it's on any more of a right-wing course than it ever is. Carter was a right-wing president. Kennedy was a right-wing president. Kennedy was a jingoistic president. He invaded Cuba and heated up the Vietnam War. So far, Ronald Reagan seems quite mild compared to what Jack tried to do and failed. We're always on the right. We're always a right-wing country. Sometimes we're more militant than others, and sometimes we're more stupid than others, and sometimes we're more unlucky than other times. So I don't see anything particularly startling. I think the present administration is perhaps more inept and more stupid than most. And something in my bones tells me it's going to be the most corrupt administration since Warren Harding. This is just a guess based on my knowledge of some of the principles.
You have said that we are now in the decline of the Third Republic of America. I wonder if you could describe briefly what you mean by that and what you might envision for the Fourth Republic, what you'd like to see.
Yeah, the First Republic was the Articles of Confederation, and that was a loose alliance of 13 would-be sovereign states fighting against the common enemy, the British Crown, or rather the British Ministry in London. And then the second was the Constitution of 1787. And that Second Republic ended in 1860 when the Southern states quite rightly said that they had every right to remove themselves from the Union. And Abraham Lincoln, taking a very mystical, even metaphysical position, based not on law but on his own viscera, said, "You may not go." He said, "I have an oath registered in heaven to preserve this union." So there was a very bloody war. Out of the war came the Third Republic. And the Third Republic was a centralized nation state dedicated to empire and to expansion. By 1900, we were picked to war with Spain, and that we seized the Philippines, and we became an Asiatic power, and we've been on the march ever since. Now our armies are being defeated. We're falling back on ourselves. The plant of the country is collapsing. The cities are falling down. Educational system is god-awful. So we now have to rebuild our own country. We don't have the time to be the world's policeman, monitor, or leader, or anything else. So after a constitutional convention, let us hope we have a fourth republic, and I would like to see that republic try to achieve something for the average person who lives in the country, who is generally being ripped off now by the bank. And perhaps the Fourth Republic might be dedicated not to empire, but to civilization, something we have yet to achieve. I mean by that a society which has somehow come to a flowering, a society that has produced arts of its own, has produced an ethical system that people may not necessarily always uphold, any more than the Greeks of Pericles did. But there is an agreed-upon society. We don't have one now. It's just a bunch of warring ethnic groups. We have something called the American way of life, but we don't really have a country. Nobody feels much alliance to the United States because it's too big, it's too broken up. They feel alliances. I'm an Italo-American, or I'm a Jewish American, or I'm a Roman Catholic, or I'm a black, or I'm Hispanic, or whatever. That all these things have not yet begun to come together in any sort of unity, or to use the proper word, polity. And until we have a real polity, I don't see how we have anything but the politics of warring ethnics. And until we get a certain serenity and a certain general agreement about purpose, you're not going to build the Parthenon.
I've read that you'd like to create new jobs, improve the educational system, improve the health programs of the country, and develop alternative energy, etc. Where would this money come from to do all that?
I think the Pentagon budget could certainly be cut in half, and I think that would supply a great deal of the money that would be needed for putting in desalinization plants up and down so we can turn ocean water to fresh water, as that's one specific thing that has to be done fairly soon. I think you could get a lot more money by taxing all of the religions. They're now tax-exempt. I would tax, being ecumenical, I would tax the foundations like Rockefeller and Ford. It's been estimated that you could bring in about $100 billion a year in revenue from these tax evaders or tax exemptors, to put it politely. Then I would do something terribly radical. I would tax the corporations. They now pay practically nothing in tax, the Federal Treasury. 20 years ago, something like 40% of the income of the United States, of the United States government, came from the individual taxpayer, and about 40% came from corporate taxes. Taxes on corporate profits. 20 years later, today, about 47% of the revenue of the federal budget comes from the individual taxpayer. A big bite is put on the middle class, particularly. And only 10% comes from the corporations. They are now paying practically nothing. After all, they've had 20 to 30 years, of a Congress which they have owned, which exempts them and exempts them and exempts them from paying taxes. If somebody like ARCO, Atlantic Richfield Oil, paid the sort of tax that an individual would pay, why, that would be $600-700 million a year into the Treasury, if not more. So tax the corporations, tax the religions, and reduce the defense budget, and there's more than enough money to restore the United States.
He said that current politics requires insincerity, and the truth would breed revolution. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit more.
Well, any society, a democratic society, there's a certain amount of insincerity that is absolutely necessary, unless you really wanted to move toward revolution. There may come a time for revolution. As Thomas Jefferson said, you know, the tree of liberty must occasionally be watered with blood. There may come a time when the rulers of the United States become so oppressive that we may have to rise up and destroy them. But that's an extreme situation which I don't see on the immediate horizon. I certainly don't look forward to it. But meanwhile, I think it's very important that in a democratic society, when a majority wants something, now a majority in Massachusetts, 1 to 2.5, That was a real, that's real democracy. Now, it's not, the officials don't want it, the bureaucracy doesn't want it. They won't cut it in the right way. They'll make dramatic gestures, which will mean that all the, you have nothing but green lights all day in Boston, so that cars will crash into one another, and they'll say, you see, 2.5 was bad. But 2.5 was real democracy. I think it's rather good to go back to point one and maybe cut all the taxes for a while and just say, look, we don't like these taxes. We think you're getting away with murder. Let's start from square one. Well, after a while, the people will say, look, the libraries are shutting down and the roads are unrepaired and the city is falling apart. And then somebody will say, well, we better raise some taxes. Then you start your revenue system all over again. Of course, you go back to taxes, but perhaps on a much fairer way. In Massachusetts, you have a problem in which your corporations are not paying tax, particularly some of the flashy new ones that have come in the last 20 or 30 years, and very good for Massachusetts. They've given a lot of work. But they were one of the main elements, I'm told, behind the 2.5 movement. And I think if they're getting away with the same murder and not paying taxes as is ARCO and ITT, that if I were the state of Massachusetts, I'd start taxing them. But I have a feeling that your politicians might be in bed, as we say, with these new companies and may not want to tax them and would rather go on with a property tax, which hurts the poor and the middle class far more than it ever does the rich.
Why should Americans now be interested in learning about the 5th century B.C.? What relevance is there? Why should we want to learn about history? And why do our leaders fear that?
Well, our leaders fear history because they invent themselves each morning. They don't have to live with their own past. All politicians do that to a certain extent, but certain ones do it to an alarming extent. I had hoped in the last presidential election that 51% of the people would not vote. And I actively led a movement to try and keep people from voting for president. And it is my view, as it was, 49% did not vote. Had we got 2 more percent, you could then say this entire system of presidential government is illegitimate since 51%, a majority of the people, refused to take part in the elections. Therefore, the system is bankrupt. Let's try something else. As for the 5th century B.C., only 5% of the people of the country read books, and I think that they would be interested in the origins of every religious and scientific and ethical and philosophic system we have today is all there in the 5th century in embryo.
That was Gore Vidal in my interview with him way back in 1981, that 2.5 of which he spoke related to Proposition 2.5, which cut taxes, limited taxes at 2.5% of property values in Massachusetts. Bert Cohen here. You are listening to Fine Aged Rock. That was an old interview from Gore Vidal from 1981, and he certainly was prescient. Things have not gotten better since then. We're going to move on to another great American who passed, this one very recently. Senator George McGovern died October 21st of 2012. And a little bit of background you may or may not know about Senator George McGovern. He was a U.S. senator from 1962 to 1980. And so many Americans had such deep affection for him, and his loss is really huge. He was called the most decent man in the United States Senate. Had a great, great mind. I cast my first vote ever for him back in 1972, and here in Portsmouth in 1984, I was working at a station, WBBX, and I interviewed many presidential wannabes back then. And after interviewing Senator McGovern, it just knocked my socks off. And I left the area to work on his behalf in the 1984 presidential campaign. I created this little gizmo. Picture the technology. I had a remember, the telephones came in two parts. There was the base and the handheld receiver. Well, I took the receiver and put a little electric plug in there so we could take tape recordings on my little cassette recorder and plug the tape recorder into the telephone and send it out to radio stations all across the state of Iowa. So they had great, what was called then, actualities of Senator McGovern. And he did come in a tight third there. He was most appreciative and recognized that my work did make a difference, but it was all about him. It really was. Of course, Walter Mondale became the nominee back in 1984 and, of course, lost to President Reagan. I had a chance to get to know Senator McGovern, traveling around with him, and I'll never forget carrying some of his luggage, and it was one that was incredibly heavy. It was filled with books. Now, how many presidential candidates read so voraciously as he did? George McGovern was an authentic American hero. He told the truth about Vietnam, and he made the claim that Congress had legitimate authority over war making. That's what it says in the Constitution, and it was his bill that helped get us out of Cambodia. He wanted to save lives and change directions. Now, not a lot of people know that he was a heck of a hero in the Second World War. He was in the 455th Bombardment Group of the 15th Air Force at San Giovanni Airfield near Cerignola in the Apulia region of Italy. He flew 35 missions over enemy territory from San Giovanni. The first five is co-pilot for an experienced crew, and the rest is pilot for his own plane, known as the Dakota Queen, named after his wife, Eleanor. His targets were all over Austria, Czechoslovakia, Germany, Hungary, Poland, and his targets were oil refineries and rail yards, all as part of the U.S. strategic bombing campaign in Europe. He flew 8 or 9 hour missions again and again and again, a grueling test of endurance for pilots and crew, while German fighter aircraft were still shooting at him. George McGovern's missions often faced heavy anti-aircraft artillery fire that filled the sky with flax, and a piece of shrapnel came through his windshield and missed, fatally wounding George McGovern by just a few inches. At the end of the Second World War, Senator McGovern flew food relief flights to northern Italy. He was the first director of John Kennedy's high-priority Food for Peace program, which realized what McGovern had been advocating for his many years in Washington. During an audience in Rome with Pope John Paul XXIII, the Pope praised McGovern's work, and the distribution program was also popular among South Dakota's wheat farmers, as you can imagine. In 1984, I'll never forget traveling with him, he said, now this was during the Cold War, he said, "We can do more to dry up the swamplands of despair that breed communism with our agricultural, medical, technological, and education help. We can do far more to dry up those swamplands of despair with these things than with all the weapons in our vast military arsenal." He wrote many, many books. Of course, he was a vocal opponent of the war in Iraq, likening U.S. involvement in that country to the failed Vietnam effort. And in 2006, he co-wrote a book, Out of Iraq, A Practical Plan for Withdrawal Now. In 2008, Senator McGovern wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post calling for the impeachment of President George W. Bush and Vice President Cheney, saying they had violated the U.S. Constitution, transgressing national and international law, and repeatedly lied to the American people. The subtitle of the article was, "Nixon was bad, these guys are worse." He wrote a number of books, including Terry, My Daughter's Life and Death Struggle with Alcoholism. I got to know Terry a bit out there in 1984. He wrote The Essential America, Our Founders and the Liberal Tradition. And in 2001, he wrote What It Means to Be a Democrat. And I remember my sense in talking to him after this interview was that he refused to be old. President Obama said, quote, "George McGovern dedicated his life to serving the country he loved. He signed up to fight in World War II and became a decorated bomber pilot over the battlefields of Europe. When the people of South Dakota sent him to Washington, this hero of war became a champion for peace. And after his career in Congress, he became a leading voice in the fight against hunger. George McGovern was a statesman of great conscience and conviction." This is the president speaking. "Michelle and I share our thoughts and prayers with his family." Well, let's hear from my final interview with George McGovern. Senator George McGovern, was a sky pilot in the Second World War, less known for that than for many, many other things. Senator McGovern, thank you very much for being with us today on the Burt Cohen Show.
Under President Clinton, McGovern served as ambassador to the UN Agencies for Food and Agriculture in Rome. Well, again, thank you very much for being with us today, Senator. In your most recent book, What It Means to Be a Democrat, you say, we are at a crossroads over how the federal government in Washington and state legislatures and city councils across the land allocate their financial resources. Which fork we will take will say a lot about Americans and our values. Well, my question is, how are we doing?
I think the United States is at a crossroads in terms of its politics. It has become so negative and so partisan. When I was a member of the United States Senate and the House of Representatives, a total of some 22 years, I never saw such narrow, negative, mean-spirited partisanship in the Congress of the United States. And one hears it night and day on the media. So I finally decided to write a book, not what I'm against, but what I think Democrats should be for. I'm not going to use this book to blast the Republican Party. They're doing that to themselves with these presidential contenders assailing each other week after week. And so this book is a positive book. What does the Democratic stand for? Or perhaps more specifically, what do I think the Democratic Party should stand for?
I wonder if, you know, what's going on with the...
It seems that the Democratic Party and candidates' connection to working people is not as solid as it was. And I wonder, did it start with the Reagan Democrats? Why is there this disconnect with working people, the people who traditionally been solidly with the Democrats? What can we do now to improve that situation? What's caused the disconnect and what can we do now?
Well, as you know, the labor unions are considerably weaker today than they were a quarter of a century ago. It used to be that we could pretty much depend as Democrats on a strong vote from organized labor. But now the unions are considerably weaker than they were. I think one of the reasons for that is that these so-called social issues have come to play a major part in our politics. You know, issues like growth, let's take the abortion issue. That issue shouldn't even be in politics.
Right.
That's not something for politicians in Washington to spend their time on in the Senate and in the House of Representatives. It's a very personal issue that is largely a female issue. You know,
sure.
You and I are never going to have an abortion.
Right.
No matter how hard we try, we're never going to have an abortion. It just doesn't happen to us males. So I just leave that issue to the women. I trust their judgment on it, and they can talk to their doctors about it. And I think that's an issue that we ought to leave in the hands of the women.
And it seems that the polling data shows that women are going with Democrats a heck of a lot more than Republicans these days. And you know as better than I that Democrats may be in great shape in a moment, but there's a long history of Democrats snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. We're in very good shape now. But I wonder if Democrats are offering clear enough alternatives. Are we making the most of the Democratic opportunity right now? Are Democrats being proactive enough? Or are we still just being reactive? Are we taking the opportunities we have?
Well, there's so much clearer on where they stand on public issues than our opponents. You know, it's hard to tell listening to these four or five people that are running for the Republican presidential nomination, on any given day, it's hard to describe what they're for. We know some of the things they're against because they talk about that over and over again. But I think the American people are more interested in what we stand for. What is the election of candidates A, B, and C going to mean in terms of improvements in our lives? And that's the thing that I try to do in this book, what it means to be a Democrat. I don't think there's much of a negative tone in that book, and I don't spend a lot of time talking about what's wrong with the Republican Party. 95% of that book is concentrated on what the Democratic Party is for. And I think it's the way it should be. You know, we need two strong, active political parties in the United States. A conservative party, which traditionally has been the Republican Party, and a liberal party, which traditionally has been the Democratic Party. Now, some of the things I hear coming out of these Republican presidential contenders tells me very little about what they're for. It tells me a lot about what they're against. Anything the Democrats are for, they seem to be against. They're even against Social Security and Medicare as they now stand. I think those are two of the most valuable and important programs on the statute books.
And we all remember in 1964 when a lot of people across the country kind of made fun of Barry Goldwater for being so right-wing. How do you think the people like Santorum today, Michelle Bachmann, people like that, compared to the Republican Party of Barry Goldwater?
Well, look, I would say this about Senator Goldwater and I were personal friends. Some people are surprised to hear that, but it's true.
Sure.
He always admired me because of my war record in the Second World War, flying a B-24 bomber on 35 missions against the most heavily defended targets in Europe. So he was always on a very congenial, personal basis with me. And I think that's the way it should be. I happen to be a close friend of Republican Senator Bob Dole. He and I have teamed up on the McGovern-Dole International School Lunch Program. And that's the way politics should be. We can't get much done if we don't have some bipartisan cooperation.
Senator, was it this part? I guess it wasn't this partisan during your tenure in the Senate. Or could it be that it's amplified, the partisan rancoring only amplified because of the 24-hour news cycle and the social media? Or has it really changed that much in terms of bipartisanship and civility?
Yes, it has changed. And I think you're quite right that that's also the tone of much of our media. You know, you listen to some of these talk show hosts that speak to millions and millions of Americans every week. These are guys that exploit fear. They exploit anxiety. They exploit frustration. And that's what keeps them in business, is the basic negative emotional feelings that are too strong across the country, partly because such negative or nervous feelings or fear feelings are aroused by media talk show kings.
Yeah, they definitely are. And fear, certainly one of the people that both you and I have admired the most, Franklin Roosevelt, understood the power of fear. And we've seen fear manipulated purposely by President George W. Bush and many others. I wonder if we're starting to get beyond that. Are Democrats countering fear with optimism? Certainly hope was the word used in the Obama campaign in 2008. I wonder where we're going with that. Are we getting over the fear? Are we seeing beyond that? Are we still being jerked around by the people who manipulate the fear?
You know, we had this one major terrorist attack on the United States. That was 9/11.
Of course.
2001. That's about 11 years ago. I think it's possible that we are overdoing our reaction to terrorism.
Yes.
You know, we've just had that one major attack. We could have another one, I suppose, just like we have 40 to 50,000 people killed in automobile accidents every year.
Right.
Now, when we invest so much of our time and energy and money in preparing against a possible repeat of the attack of 9/11, I think we are overdoing it. I go to the airport quite frequently. I'm still out traveling around the country. I do quite a bit of speaking. I'm now out promoting my book. But, you know, it's gotten to the point where I don't enjoy very much my visit to the airports anymore. You line up behind a big, winding line of people who are preparing to take their shoes off and walk around either barefoot or in stocking feet because of one guy,
right,
apparently had either flour or some other kind of white powder in his shoes. Now, that was many, many years ago, but we're still afraid of that guy. Look, every time you get in an automobile or an airplane, you're taking a risk. There's just a certain amount of accidents that are going to occur. But I think we've way overdone the fear that there might be a terrorist on board. I was talking to some of my friends the other day about that, and they said, well, George, at least you got to admit we haven't had another attack since 9/11. I said, no. And we never had an attack before 9/11 of that dimension. So I'd like to be able to keep my shoes on when I prepare to go on an airplane. I hate going through these kind of search and destroy tactics that hit us at the airport. I'm more nervous about them and more fearful about them than I am the danger of another terrorist attack.
And, Senator, I loved a line in your new book. We live with too much fear and not enough common sense, so it seems. We can use some common sense. I wanted to move on. You know, one of the great things about Franklin Roosevelt was stimulating the economy, creating a lot of much-needed public works jobs. The people needed work. There was a lot of work to be done. It seems to me like we're in a similar situation now. And yet, a lot of Republicans argue we can no longer afford social investments. We have to reduce the deficit. Why is it that Democrats, you know, Obama did a little stimulus. It seems, I'm guessing you probably think it wasn't really enough. Why did Democrats shy away from public works jobs? It would so clearly stimulate demand and help the economy. What is it? Why do we shrink from that?
Well, I think the answer to that is that it takes some cooperation from the other party to get things done. They control the House of Representatives, so you can't get anything through Congress that doesn't have the endorsement of the House. House of Representatives, so that's a Republican body. And I think that's the biggest problem that President Barack Obama has had. You know, it's interesting. Within a few days of the election of President Obama, the Republican leader in the Senate, this fellow from Kentucky, his name slips my mind right
Mitch McConnell?
Now. But, pardon?
Mitch McConnell?
Yeah, Mitch McConnell. He put out a public statement that he was going to use the next 4 years to defeat the Obama administration and all their works, that he would do everything he could to block this new president from getting anything through Congress. Well, that's not the way to be a patriot in the United States. You don't say you hope the president's going to fail and you're going to try to make sure he does. You know, in the 22 years I served in the House and Senate, I never once heard a leader of either party say they hoped the president of the United States would be a failure and that they were going to do everything they could to make sure he's a failure, that he doesn't get another term. I don't think that's patriotic. What has happened to pride in America? What has happened to cooperation on key problems between the two parties? We had that during all those years I was in the Congress. You know that I was very much opposed to sending young Americans over to that jungle in Vietnam.
Yes.
Now just about everybody knows that war was a dreadful mistake. But to try to stop it, I teamed up with a prominent Republican senator, Mark Hatfield, and we introduced in the Senate the McGovern-Hatfield Amendment to end the war. And we almost had enough votes to pass it through the Congress because we cooperated together instead of trying to defeat each other. And I think that's the kind of spirit we need now at a time when the country is in an economic crisis.
Should there be more of a stimulus? Do you think this is a good time for new public works jobs that that could, you know, create jobs? And do you think that would be a good way to stimulate the economy? I understand there's massive resistance to that in the Congress, but do you think that would be a good thing for Democrats to be talking about as the election heads our way?
Yes, I do. Absolutely. I'm not sure, and I don't know anybody else who is sure, that private industry can provide a job for everybody who wants to work. It may be that we've reached a situation where while they have great talent, great ability, that the private industry can't provide a job for every American that wants to work.
Clearly.
That was also the case in the 1930s during the Great Depression. So what President Roosevelt did was to say, look, I'm not going to let 10, 15 million people sit around and do nothing. I'm going to put them to work in useful public employment that would help the country, building up the national parks, building up the national forest, building new bridges and courthouses and highways and water systems. All of those things need to be revitalized today, and they are public matters that demand public employment. So, yes, I think the Democrats should have pushed harder in that direction, but I also want to be realistic about this.
Right.
You know, Bert, that the Republicans would not have permitted that kind of a New Deal program to pass this time. You get control of the House of Representatives by a substantial margin, and they would rush to the barricades to block these programs that I just mentioned, almost 100% strong. So it's a good idea. The Democrats should be pushing it, but it won't pass as long as the Republicans remain in control of the House of Representatives. A bill has to pass both houses to become law. And so this is the problem we're up against right now.
I would think with the election, you know, in full swing now, that it might be a good thing to talk about. And, you know, Democrats, I've been frustrated by what's been called the blue dog Democrats. It seems to me that showing leadership, standing up for something, you know, talking about public works jobs, and yes, one of your favorite subjects, railroads, it would help us just electorally, even, you know, recognizing that there's, you know, huge opposition in Congress. I think
I think that's right, and I wish the Democratic Party would come out four square for a series of work projects. You know, for the last 40 years, I thought that such a project might be building in America the fastest, the safest, the cleanest railway system in the world. And we get our money back several times over if we invested it in constructive projects of that kind. Let me just give you an illustration of how wisely invested public programs pay for themselves. Social Security. That's not a burden on the taxpayers of this country, because from the very beginning, it's been financed by withholding payments from the working people of America. The last I checked, they had a $2 trillion surplus in the Social Security trust fund. Let me say it in another case. I'm a beneficiary of the GI Bill of Rights that followed World War II. I came home from my bomber days in that war, and lo and behold, even though I had a wife and one child, the little girl being born while I was overseas in World War II, we had this wonderful GI Bill. You could go to any college in the country, from Harvard and UCLA and Stanford and Princeton, or you could go to Podunk Junior College, and the government would pay all your expenses, all your tuition, all your fees, all your books, plus a cost of living allowance. It cost a huge amount of money. But you want to know something? The government made big money on that program. Why? Because by educating 8 million GIs from World War II, they increased their educational standing, and they educated us in a way that we've been earning more money ever since. Still are. So that for every dollar the government shelled out to pay to educate 8 million GIs, they got back $2 in return. But I'm going to have to leave in a few minutes. We've been on about a half hour somewhere about near the end of this. Am I correct?
Yes. I wondered if I could just ask one more thing about food.
Oh, sure.
You've said compassion does more than make people feel good. It's a smart way to approach the world. You argue that food is more effective and cheaper in terms of foreign policy than trillions of dollars on weapons. Why isn't that?
Absolutely. You know, the first big splurge in our national debt came in the 1980s during the Reagan years. Why? Because he did two things in his 8 years in office. Every one of those 8 years, he sharply increased military spending. At the same time, he gave all the rich people a tax cut.
Yeah.
Well, you can't cut your revenues at the same time you're spending more money without having a big debt. And that's exactly what happened. $4 $2 trillion added to the national debt in the 8 years of President Reagan. He was a congenial man, a popular actor. Everybody liked him. But the truth is that his fiscal policies were unsound. Now, it happened again under President Bush Jr.
Right.
He did the same thing. He cut taxes for the rich even more than Reagan had done. And then he got us into two wars, Iraq and Afghanistan. And he added $5 trillion to the national debt. That's a total of $9 trillion added by Reagan and Bush, which is over half of the entire national debt. In contrast, President Bill Clinton reduced the national debt in his last 2 years in office and left a large surplus in the Treasury for his successors. So we need to get those facts out to the American people. We Democrats are not the kind of wild big spenders that the Republicans paint us to be. If you want some wild spending, look at the Reagan administration and the Bush Jr. administration. If you want some irresponsible tax policy, look at those two administrations for tax cuts that were given to people that least need it. These are hard facts that we ought to be talking about frequently.
And I do remember how often you've said about food, you know, if the U.S. shows leadership in terms of food, medical help, agricultural supplies, that's a much more effective foreign policy. I know you have to go, Senator McGovern. It's been an honor. America would have been very blessed to have had you as president. It doesn't look likely that that's going to happen at this point. But thank you so much.
Bert, it's good to be on. I just want to say on the food situation, that has been the central passion of my life ever since World War II. I saw genuine hunger during that war. I saw children starving to death. I saw mothers gaunt and underfed and poorly fed. So I've been trying to reduce hunger in the world every way I possibly can ever since World War II. Now, we're making progress. In fact, we've made enormous progress on that effort, and we need to keep moving it.
We do, and that's a great way for America to show our leadership. The new book is What It Means to Be a Democrat. The author, Senator George McGovern, thank you so much for being with us. Quite an honor. Thank you.
Thanks to you, Bert. It's been my pleasure.
All right. Thank you so much.
My country, it is of thee. Sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the
George McGovern is gone. It's up to us to keep his spirit alive. and to continue to press for his values, great American values. Thanks very much for listening.